Hey, y'all, I hope you're having a great week. Oh, I'm so excited about this episode. I have to start off by just saying I was a little bit intimidated by this interview, okay? Because the guy that we're gonna have on the show is just very fancy and he's very smart and he's very accomplished and he does things like write award-winning plays and operas and poems, and his work has won him very prestigious awards like the Penn American Award for Drama and the Guggenheim Fellowship. Can you start to see why I'm feeling a little bit intimidated? But I have to say, Dan O'Brien, as successful and smart and fancy as he is so warm and down to earth and generous and open and honest. And I just loved this conversation. He shares with us really vulnerably and open about his childhood trauma, about his battle with cancer and how that transformed him, about how storytelling really has healed him and been really therapeutic and important for him. We also kind of explore this season of his life where he was facing rejection in his art. And so I think for any of you who are kind of working through this really valid and big question of like, what I'm doing doesn't seem to be like received well by the world. You've got two choices, right? You can take the feedback and the input and see that feedback as kind of great information that should change and help you grow. You can actually kind of dig your heels in and say, no, I believe in this thing. And even if it's getting rejected, I'm going to keep going in this direction. And then there's all sorts of choices that lay somewhere in the middle. It's a nuanced, complicated subject, and there is no one right answer. But I love having these conversations because I think the more we hear from one another about how we've navigated those challenging seasons in our art, our craft, our career, our relationships, whatever it is, we just get this collective wisdom that we all get to kind of pull from and live into. And so that's what Dan does for us today. I'm so excited for y'all to hear more from our guest today, Dan O'Brien. All right, Dan, thank you so much for joining us on the show. I'm really, really excited to get to know you more.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I have to say, we've, you know, read your fancy bio to our audience, and I need you to know that I learned something new. I had to Google libretist. So I don't know how many people who are listening. It's just like literally it's also in the first line of your bio, which I feel like we typically reserve for more common knowledge. So I have to say that when I had to Google what that actually meant, it was a little bit humbling. But you write operas? Is that right?
Well, and the libretto, strictly speaking, is just the text of an opera.
Oh, so it's okay.
Like writing, you know, the story and then writing the lyrics. Sometimes you'll, you know, someone else will write the lyrics. And a libretto is strictly just the story and if there's any spoken dialogue. You're not alone. You know, years ago when I wrote my first libretto, I'm sure I had to Google it as well to figure out what it was.
Well,
it does sound fancy. It sounds very fancy.
For someone who definitely pays for the Word of the Day app, I'm really happy to have a new word in my lexicon. So thank you for that.
Good. No, you're welcome.
Dan, I know you have done probably a lot of thinking, of processing through your childhood, through your upbringing, through your family of origin, based off of your newest book. Will you share with us, we love on this show, as we kind of are talking about how we demystify this like supposedly oftentimes linear path towards finding our passion or our purpose. Will you take us as far back into the Dan O'Brien story as you're willing to take us and kind of shed a little bit of light on your childhood, your family of origin, things about you as a child that you may or may not be able to kind of connect to who you are today?
Yeah, sure. I'm thinking a lot about this because I'm about to publish this memoir. So I've been going back and proofreading this text that I started maybe 9 years ago. In many ways, it feels like a book that I've been writing since I first started writing around 12, 13 years old. If you're writing a story of your child, in some ways, it feels like you've been writing it from the moment you were born, you know? So it's these questions are on my mind. And I was thinking about this idea of failure in relation to my family in all kinds of ways. So I grew up in a big Irish-American family in Scarsdale, New York. And some people may know that Scarsdale is, you know, kind of well-known as a very affluent suburb of New York City. It's about 20 miles north of the city. And but I grew up in a family that was not wealthy, wasn't affluent. We were kind of maybe masquerading as such in that community. My parents met at the Scarsdale High School prom, or actually their first date was the high school prom. Wow. And so they grew up in Scarsdale as well, and they got married young and started having kids. And it was, you know, I would describe it as a, you know, a moderately to severely unhappy childhood. Many people have much more difficult upbringings, but ours was tough, and it had a lot to do with my parents' mental illness, untreated mental illness, and then subsequently, whether it was genetic and or environmental, their children, some of their children to varying degrees, dealing with mental illness. And for me, the most formative challenge or trauma of my childhood was when my older brother attempted suicide by throwing himself, jumping out the attic window of our house, which was an event that I witnessed firsthand. And, you know, that event is kind of, that's sort of the center of the memoir in a lot of ways, how it formed me for better and for worse. In many ways, it sent me on a trajectory as an artist and as a writer. Mm. But that idea of, you know, failure was there, you know, it was connected for me at the beginning to the idea of depression too. Mm. You know, this idea that my older brother at 17, I was 12, he was 17, you know, he seemed to be failing in some way. Mm. You know, he wasn't thriving socially, he wasn't thriving at school. He was clearly, if he was suicidal, he was clearly something wasn't working. And sort of my childhood brain responded to that with this sense that I had to be the opposite of him in some way. And one way to do that was, like I said, by writing and being an artist and trying to, you know, express what I was going through artistically. But it was also, too, this feeling I had from a young age that I had to be successful, had to be successful at being a writer, which any writer will tell you is kind of a recipe for disaster, because there's so much, of course, so much rejection involved in being a writer, being an artist. You know, if you're writing poetry, how do you measure success? You know, when a best-selling book of poetry sells 400 copies, how do you measure success?
Is so, that a real statistic?
That's, I mean, it's anecdotal. I've seen that written about, that very well-known poets winning very prestigious awards will still sell 500, 400 copies, you know? So, but yeah, so from the beginning in that family, in that childhood, I did feel like I needed to sort of escape that family, escape that environment. Yeah. And one way to do it was by some form of success. And, you know, over the years, and with the help of some failures and with the help of therapy and all kinds of things, you know, I've changed my ideas about what success means to me, you know. And that's,
so
that's
your
an ongoing question.
You had mentioned kind of starting your writing journey at around the age of, I think you said 12 or 13. How
12,
old were
yeah.
you when your brother, when that, when your brother... attempted suicide?
Yeah, I was 12. I mean, I was writing before that. I was certainly like one of those kids that just liked writing stories and liked reading. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was probably told by teachers, oh, you're good at this, you know. But it was after what happened with my brother, you know, it of course coincided with adolescence and puberty. So suddenly writing became this serious thing for me. You know, I discovered quote-unquote serious literary writers that spoke to me. It meant a lot to me. Anne Sexton, the confessional poets, were hugely influential, because these were poets especially who were just, they were speaking the truth. They were telling the truth, usually about taboo subjects, like mental illness, like suicide, all kinds of things. And they were making something artful and poetic. They're making some kind of sense or meaning out of chaos, out of, you know, something negative.
It's interesting that it sounds like in this really formative moment of just like, that's such a traumatic thing to happen. It's such a tender age where it's like, you're old enough to get a lot of it, but you're not old enough to have the tools to work through it. That writing and poetry, on the one hand, was like a very honest, really fulfilling, meaningful thing for you to process and for you to feel a sense of understanding. And then yet it seems like really quickly it maybe got attached to this like, oh, and maybe I'm a little good at this. And maybe my teachers are noticing that. And I have this now new mission in life to not fail or be trouble or whatever it is. That you took this thing was really serving you really honestly, and then kind of attached this sense of like, this will be the thing that I find purpose in, or that I am successful in, or that saves me from this like other path. Does that feel like an accurate kind of description of that early love?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, those two ideas of one, it being something just for me in a kind of pure sense to write something for my emotions or my spirituality, like, and then this idea that writing would somehow help me escape my family and lead me to a happier life in some way. They didn't always overlap. You know, sometimes they felt like very separate ideas, and I could keep them separate. And actually, in many ways, I feel happiest when I do keep them separate. Do you know what I mean? Like when I can, at the age age I am now. Well, even at the age I am now, you know, there are times when I can sit down to write and I can feel that I am just writing for myself or for some imagined reader, or if it's a play or a libretto for an audience, you know, and I'm not at all thinking about success or failure in terms of what happens to it in the marketplace, in the real world, you know.
Okay, so obviously, I have a very honest question that I want to ask you about that.
Sure.
You have experienced a high degree of external affirmation for your art, right? You've won awards and you've like, you know, brought your work into spheres that a lot of other playwrights and poets and memoirists would look at and go like, okay, he's done it. He's made it. Do you feel like getting that affirmation from others is like requisite to arriving to the place that you're at now, where you're like, oh, I got all of the success, and now I'm in this place where I'm actually kind of released from the need for my art to be successful, and it can kind of just be what it needs to be? Do you think that, let's just say you never got there, that you were just like a poet and you loved it and you wrote it, but no one ever really affirmed it? Do you think you would have arrived in the same place, or is it like, is that a special treasure reserved for those on the other side of success?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if I'm understanding the question correctly, I don't know. I don't know if you can ever feel, or if I ever feel like I've arrived at some kind of place that feels like success. It always evaporates. Like anytime, you know, somebody says, oh, here's an award, or here's a publication, or you know, it feels good, of course, but it doesn't last very long. You know, for example, I have not read a review of any of my work in 25 years.
What?
And friends of mine can't believe it, and or they can't believe that I don't read the good ones. And the truth is, I don't want to read either one of them because I find them so destabilizing. And I'm trying to protect that place in my psyche and my creativity that feels safe, I suppose, but also kind of pure. You know, I still hear, like, if I have a play production, I'll still see blurbs on a poster, or I won't see blurbs, and that's interesting too. You know, or you'll see a blurb for your play, but it only mentions the performances. That's usually a dead giveaway that it was a mixed review and maybe they didn't like the play so much. So, you know, of course I can kind of sometimes soak up what the reception has been, but my psyche just can't bear to really engage too much with other people's opinion. And maybe that's connected to that feeling of, you know, maybe if I read only the good reviews, I could be at a place where I felt, quote unquote, successful, and I would be writing differently. You know, I feel like you have to write from a place of doubt. You know, I think if you write from a place of too much security, the work is gonna be less somehow. Less human or less you know, searching or something. So that's part of it too. But it's also just an innate feeling that I think most people and artists feel. I think it's called the hedonic treadmill. I think that's a psychoanalytical term. This idea that, you know, the moment your brain acclimatizes to success and failure, it's not just success, but you know, so it's good. You know, you might feel good for a few hours, a few days, a few weeks, a certain burst of confidence, which I'll, you know, enjoy as much as I can, but eventually you acclimatize and you're feeling just as insecure as the next time. And also if with each new project, if you're trying something new, you can't really fall back on the previous book or the previous play and say, well, that one did okay, so this one probably will. And I you know, I feel like you have to always start a new play or book or with a feeling of, I don't know, you know, a feeling of exploration and experimentation, you know.
That's good. Okay, well, you take us. Okay, so from a pretty young age, you had a propensity for writing and reading and poetry. Will you walk us through, did that really set you on a trajectory early on? Were you like a 13-year-old Dan was like, I'm going to be a writer, and this is my ticket out of Dodge? And is that, tell us a little bit about the path that you pursued.
Yeah, I was. I think I was annoying in that way. My wife says I am, and that I have been pretty monomaniacal, I think is the word.
Yeah.
You know, I for a while. So, you know, I was writing. I went to college, and I studied theater and creative writing. So theater was important to me, and for a short amount of time, I probably thought maybe I'd be an actor, or I definitely thought maybe I would be a performer, either in addition to writing or something. But being a writer did always feel like an identity more than a behavior or even a profession. So for better and for worse, it was kind of what I, just who I felt like I was from a young age, you know. I didn't necessarily know how to do it or how to make a career out of it. I definitely didn't know how to make a career out of it. I went to a college, Middlebury College in Vermont, and one of the reasons I wanted to go there is because my mother used to bring home this book from the library, this series of books. I think it was called Writers on Writing, and it was an anthology of essays by writers about writing from the Breadloaf Writers Conference, which is I think the oldest literary conference in the country, and it's part of Middlebury College. It's in Breadloaf, Vermont. Okay. So, you know, from a young age, I had this idea that Middlebury was where you went if you wanted to be a writer, and Vermont seemed like this idyllic place to get in touch with nature, you know, so maybe I thought I'd be a nature poet or something. So I was kind of pursuing that and following that inspiration from the beginning. After college, I spent about a year in Ireland doing something called the Watson Fellowship. It's a organization associated with like 60 different liberal arts colleges, and seniors apply for their year after college to conduct a course of independent study anywhere in the world. So my proposal was to go to Ireland and study by myself Irish theater. Specifically for me, I was interested in sort of folklore and amateur theater. So I did that for a year, which involved just a lot of backpacking and getting drunk and I acted in a few plays. I joked with friends before I went that I wouldn't get a chance to act in Ireland unless they were doing David Mamet plays, you know, on every corner. And within a week in Cork City, Ireland, I was cast in a David Mamet play. and was doing that at a little pub theater in Cork, Ireland. But it was great experience, you know, to get inside not just a theater, but get inside the culture, playing kind of a stereotypical American or prototypical American play and playwright.
You know, so what I did I that. Love about that is that the idea that there, and I've never experienced pub theater in Ireland, but I'm like kind of trying to imagine it, and I'm imagining that it's kind of like a relatively low stakes, not super professional, low barrier to entry. And we, I'm going, what do we have in the US that's like remotely similar to that? And I feel like the answer is nothing. Like, I think we live in a really unique culture in the United States where it's the bar to entry, I feel like, oftentimes, especially in the arts, feels so high that it's like you either do something and you're a professional and you're good at it and you get famous for it, or you don't. And if you try to do something at kind of that lower level, that's actually like kind of embarrassing or cringy. And I have a friend who is really well traveled, and at her wedding, she was like, I've been to so many weddings in other places in the world. And one of the really interesting things that I notice is people perform more. Like, there's just kind of this sense of like, you can sing without being a singer. You can put on a skit without being a professional comedian. And so for her wedding, she was like, my dream is that all of my friends who are not professional performing artists perform. Like, you go perform for me, which I thought was just like a hoot. Like, I had the time of my life. Like, somebody giving me a permission slip to be like, you're not a professional, you're not good, no one would ever pay to see you do this, but like, you've got an audience of 500, what are you going to do with it? And it just made me realize that I feel sad about that part of our culture, that we don't have a lot of opportunities, I feel like, for people to experiment in performance in a way that feels like really low stakes. You don't have to be good at this. You don't have to want to do this with your life. It's just like, it's a way to bring people together or to experiment. And so I feel like your experience in Ireland feels exactly like that, of just kind of this like low stakes community-based way to like engage, make each other laugh, think, connect.
Yeah. I mean, I was fascinated by amateur theater there. I mean, they make a big distinction, or maybe I should make a big distinction between what we would call community theater in this country, which really is, you know, more just volunteer people with regular careers, just doing this for fun. Maybe some people think it's a little cringy or something, but there's no like attempt to like parlay a community theater production into a professional career, usually.
Yeah.
Whereas in Ireland, the amateur theater company is an amateur theater is considered an entry point for some people, for a lot of people in many ways. So it's kind of like, it's not quite community theater, but it's not quite, I don't know what we would think of as off Broadway or off regional theaters. It's sort of in between. But I think you're right. It's also just a different culture. I mean, what you were saying reminded me of my first night in Ireland. I went to see a play in Limerick, of all places, in Limerick, Ireland. And I was invited to the cast party that night. And sure, it was a theater party, but it was understood that every single person at the party had to sing a song. or they could either sing a song or tell a story, tell a joke, a long joke, something. They'd have a party piece, essentially.
Yeah.
And it was really, I mean, maybe this, I was led to believe this was kind of standard in that culture, or more prevalent than in the U.S. And I loved that. I loved that difference and that change. And I learned so much that year in terms of how to, you know, think of how I wanted to think of myself as an artist and as a writer and, you know, and as an American. A big point of the Watson Fellowship is to get people outside of the country who wouldn't normally have the means to do that. You know, my family couldn't afford to send me for a year backpacking around Ireland, you know, and I didn't have the money to do that. So this was, you know, the chance to have that experience, to be outside of my own culture, thinking about what it meant to be an American in the eyes of another country. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, talk about formative experiences. I think about what happened with my brother when I was 12 as a huge formative experience. And I think about that year in Ireland as a huge experience. And I'm writing about both continually to this day.
I love that. I'd love to kind of hear, you know, your story is interesting. The research shows, and I think anecdotally on this show, it feels really consistent with the research, that about 80% of people in their young adult period, you know, between 18 and 25, cannot definitively say, like, I know what I want to be about. I know the path that I want to pursue. And you did. So you're a minority. You're like kind of you're our 20%, which it sounds like your wife finds to be annoying to be married to a 20%er. But I am curious. So it's like you kind of had a different road than the majority of us who really probably spent a lot of our early adulthood wrestling, searching, experimenting, failing, probably trying to put the pieces together, maybe accidentally stumbling upon something that we found interest in or were good at. And you kind of like leapfrogged over that like wrestling period that 80% of people go through. Yet I imagine that your road to refining that wasn't necessarily completely, you know, linear, that you didn't immediately come back home from Ireland and experience success upon success. Will you share with us a little bit about a moment on the journey that even though you kind of had this level of confidence of who you are, of what you love, of what you're good at, of what you want to kind of bring about in the world, a time or a moment or a season that you would define as a pluck up?
I mean, there's so many times when, especially as a young writer, I felt like what I had written had failed in some fashion. And I was being told that it had failed. One of my first plays, the theater has a very extensive system of development where there are lots of readings, sort of public readings of plays, new plays, sometimes for years and years before a play is finally produced for an audience. And it's still a professional start to a career. And I think it might have been my first reading. It was in a hot gymnasium on Cape Cod with an audience. I was young, but they seemed very old. They seemed ancient, elderly, which is a theme through the career of a playwright, especially a young playwright, feeling like you're creating plays for audiences the age of your grandparents. Mm. This audience hated it. They just absolutely hated it. I still vividly remember certain comments. You know, one person stood up and said, well, this is the other thing. So new play readings, you'll do the play. The actors will read the play. They'll have the script in hand. They'll kind of act it out, but there's no sets. There's no lighting. There's no costumes. And they're still reading the script. And then afterwards, the director or dramaturg or someone will say to the audience, okay, now let's tell the playwright what you think of the play. And the playwright has to just sit up there and try to look as harmless as possible or as charming as possible. And hope and pray that they don't, the audience doesn't turn on you. And somebody stood up and said, I hate to tell you to start over, but start over. That was one comment. Another said, I remember this other old man said, he said, your play, it's like an indigestible soup.
Oh, no.
Which I thought was very creative. I mean, he's like, you know, he's giving me this simile and it wasn't wrong. Like, I can look back on it and I can sort of see it certainly wasn't a perfect play, you know. It was also just stylistically the type of play that maybe your average 80-year-old man at the time wasn't going to get or enjoy,
right?
You know.
And
so
do you feel like when you were when you were sitting on stage receiving that feedback, were you able to kind of see that in the moment of like, okay, this guy doesn't necessarily, you know, sometimes I think we can get feedback, negative feedback from a certain type of person that actually feels like positive feedback. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when somebody who I'm in fashion. And so it's like when somebody who I consider to just have really terrible fashion makes a comment about how my outfit's like kind of a little bit out there. I'm generally like, thank you. I feel like that's actually because I don't align with the values you hold, your negative perception of me actually twists into some level of affirmation. Do you feel like you were able to do that in the moment of being like, this guy isn't my target audience, that's okay? Or did it really feel like, did you experience doubt or embarrassment, or like, how did it impact you in that moment?
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing, being able to sort of keep criticism in, or put it in context and have a more stable reaction, you know, came with maturity for me. You know, certainly in my 20s, it felt like, oh, these people hate it. They hate me. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're right. Maybe I'm terrible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And or maybe my writing is good, but the career won't work out. Do you know what
okay.
I mean? Like
yeah.
feeling like
yeah.
maybe in some kind of pure sense, the play is fine, but the marketplace of the theater will hate me. So,
yeah.
But again, in my 20s, I had what I think most young artists have, a lot of energy to sort of get angry maybe in response, to get defensive in response, you know, and sort of plow that energy into the next play. I mean, it didn't feel good in the moment. It certainly didn't feel good, you know, in the weeks or there's a, I think it's Terrence McNally, the playwright. He claims that one of his first reviews said, wrote, the critic wrote, if only Terrence McNally's parents had done the world a favor and smothered him in his crib.
Oh my gosh. So,
and he told that story after 40 or 50 years. So, you know, I think everybody remembers, especially in your 20s, those
yeah.
those first negative responses because they hurt so terribly.
Yeah.
And that was part of why at the age of 25, 26, I decided I'm not going to read reviews anymore.
Okay. So that was kind of came out of that experience to some degree. Because you
yeah,
weren't at a place where you could have kind of that grounded perspective. You were just like, I'm just going to remove the temptation or remove the input at all and just kind of go.
Yeah, exactly. It was to say like, it was also a feeling of like, I'm going to waste a lot of time thinking
good.
About
yeah.
this. I mean, this would be yeah. a good time to say that, you know, I have obsessive compulsive disorder.
Mm.
So, and it's managed and, you know, treated and everything. But I tend to obsess and in a compulsive way. And that's what I was doing at 25 perceived failures or negative comments. And so, you know, rather than agonize over, even again in the good review, to agonize over the one line
yeah.
that seemed maybe negative or critical, I just decided I'm going to put that to the side and try to just focus on my own paper, you know?
I love that. And, you know, I think sometimes we don't give enough credit to how the positive reviews, whether it's a technical, you know, it's you're a writer and you're actually putting work out and people are writing reviews, or it's just feedback that you're getting in your life that – it's, you know, there are these moments where people are affirming things in you. And if there needs to be a pretty clear alignment in how people are affirming you and what you believe about yourself and what you want for yourself, for even sometimes the positive ones not to get twisted and become
right.
actually a force that keeps us more in tune with what other people want and need and expect from us and how to please others. I think about right. that a lot. I have 3 young kids. And so I think about that a lot in parenting. Like, how can I affirm my kids in who they are and in these things? They're so different from each other, which is, like, such a blast. That's such a fun part about raising kids is you just see, like, wow, the same 2 biological humans made these humans, and they're so different. And so I am, like, as their mom, it's so easy for me to be like, oh, my gosh, this is such a unique thing about you. This is such a gift or, like, a thing that you bring into the world. And, like, my desire as a words of affirmation person is, like, tell them, speak that over them. But then I do have this other voice that's, like, always kind of this cautious voice of going, like, let them show you. Because I'm, like, nervous about taking something, a gift that maybe they have, and then, like, making it into a burden. Like, being, like, I'm taking this gift, and now I'm putting it back on you, but in a way that doesn't feel like it is fully who you are and who you were made to be. Because I think I've experienced maybe in my own life how sometimes even positive affirmation can kind of just ever so slightly make us like change directions a little bit, because the desire to be desired and to be wanted and to feel affirmed, it's so strong and it's so natural. And so I love that you have extended the practice of not reading reviews to be universal, whether it's like negative or positive, because the danger of kind of feeling like that could get you off course a little bit is too great.
Yeah, I think just on the simple level of it making one self-conscious about, in the act of writing or in the act of creating, you know, in a way, and I want to feel, at least in the rough draft phase of a project, that I'm kind of working subconsciously or half consciously. Like I don't want to be thinking, am I writing the way I've been described by somebody in a review? Mm-hmm. Am I writing the thing I'm supposed to write or in the way I'm supposed to write it? But I think what your point about that larger sense of like influencing like your kids, you know, in terms of affirming them, but perhaps accidentally creating almost a pressure or a burden or an expectation that they be a certain way. I think that's really interesting. You know, because I did grow up hearing, you know, from my mother especially, that I, almost like a prophecy, that I was going to be a writer. And I've thought a lot about that over the years and written about that in the memoir, you know, trying to tease apart, you know, you talk about being a member of the 20%, right? You know, how much of that was because I grew up hearing, this is who you are, this is what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, that was because she had wanted to be a writer herself. So it's kind of an age-old story of a parent projecting their own ambitions, frustrated ambitions onto a child. You know, I think there's enough that was intrinsic to who I am, that I don't feel overall like I'm sort of acting out my mother's ambition for me. But it was an ingredient in, you know, what I've done with my life, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really, teasing that out on the other side is a really interesting exercise, probably one of those questions that doesn't, you know, there's no real knowable answer, but that I think is really worth asking. Do you think it's true? I kind of am like developing this hypothesis just in myself that I'm kind of hearing a little bit in your story. I find that how I respond to failure or rejection can actually be a guiding force and indicator of if the thing that I'm doing is truly like the thing that I'm supposed to be doing. It's out of this very like deep and honest part of who I am, and it needs to come out into the world, or I'm doing it for other people and for approval or for success or whatever it is. I find that maybe this is just my personality. So I'm testing this out on you right now. That when failure impacts me really dramatically and I'm like, why am I even trying? Or I totally suck at this. Or like, I give up, I fold, I'm changing, I'm pivoting, I'm going in a different direction because that was horrible. And now I'm imagining you like sitting on stage, having somebody tell you that your play is an indigestible soup. Or that to me is actually an indicator that I wasn't actually doing it for myself in the first place. Like it's actually like, oh, if that impacts you so much and you're willing to give it up, it's probably because you were doing it for affirmation in the first place. So if you're not getting affirmation, kind of the whole point of this little show you're putting on is it's not successful because you're just in it to kind of get that affirmation. Whereas when my immediate reaction is more anger or defensiveness or kind of this, like I'm like gritting my heels into the ground a little bit, and there is the sense of like, I think you just don't understand, sir, that's actually a really powerful indicator that it's like, ooh, you find value in this thing beyond what other people say or beyond how they're experiencing it, that's like an interesting kind of like guiding force. Mm-hmm. Has that been your experience?
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying reminds me of how countless times I felt as a writer, whether it's a small rejection or a big one or a perceived failure, I've almost always, once the initial pain has worn off, I've almost always felt a stronger conviction to rededicate myself to the project, usually, if not just to writing in general. Sometimes it's to the next project. You know, sometimes a play flops and it's never produced again. But I've felt a rededication maybe to what I'm working on at that moment, you know, something new. And I think you're right. I think it's sort of, and I've said this to younger playwrights too, that, you know, failure can kind of recalibrate and send you back to the page again in a more pure way, you know, in a way that's more, again, for yourself, for your imagined, you know, ideal reader or ideal audience. And, you know, and that's a way in which failure can kind of feel like a gift, again, because it clarifies, you know. And when I've had some success, there is that, you know, distraction element where you say, oh, why was this a success and that other thing wasn't? And should I do more of that? And what exactly did I do that seemed to work this time that didn't work before, even though I'm the same writer, you know? And, you know, there's no easy answer, I think. I think you can take things away from the success and the failure. But I've often felt like the failure brings me back to a kind of starting point that feels, again, just feels more pure, you know, and ultimately more, I would say, usually when I've gone through a period in my writing life that has felt less successful, it's been during those periods that I've written something that ultimately ends up being more successful down the line.
Interesting.
So whether that's because it means I'm like working towards something new in terms of style or in terms of, you know, the subject matter, I'm not really sure. But I would imagine, you know, I look at other artists, other writers that seem to go from major success to major success. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the truth is much more complicated than that. But I do wonder, like, how do they keep their center? Do you know what I mean? How do they, you know, do they feel like they're just kind of riding this rocket of others' expectations? And are they good at providing a product that meets others' expectations? And that's great. Are they just lucky? Are they writing something that's completely organic and truthful to them and it just happens to strike a chord and continue to do that? You know, for me, it's been much more sporadic, hit and miss. And again, when things haven't worked out, you know, it hasn't always been fun, but it has led me to developing something in my voice or my craft.
And there's a real freedom that comes. It's like, can feel horrifying and desperate right when it happens, being rejected or experiencing failure. Of course, it's just terrible. And I don't know about you, but I don't think it really gets that, like, initial moment of receiving that feedback. Maybe I'm just not maturing on schedule, but my experience has been, it still feels terrible. Like, no matter how mature I am, no matter how many tools I have to deal with it, that, like, I think about the difference between our reaction and our response. Like, I would define reaction as just the thing that happens in your body and mind before you've had a chance to, like, let other parts of your brain kick in and, you know, slow down your physiological response. My reaction to failure over the course of lots of them over the last 15 years has not really changed. It's just like immediate. For me, I feel it totally in my gut. I just immediately feel like I'm going to have diarrhea. That's my physiological response to failure, is my stomach just immediately starts hurting. And oh, shoot, where was I going with this?
Well, I would say, I mean, I agree completely. And I think one thing I didn't know as like a 20-year-old writer was that a 50-year-old writer is going to be just as anxious about people liking or disliking what they write. And maybe the difference is I love your distinction between reaction and response. You know, maybe the difference is having the more mature person has hopefully a healthier response to that reaction.
Yeah.
And, you know, you know, I like to think that the sting of failure or the high of a success doesn't last as long at my age. Mm-hmm. but it's the intensity is still there. Mm-hmm. It's still the same. Mm-hmm. I'm friends with a playwright named Daisy Foote, who's the daughter of Horton Foote. He wrote, he's probably most famous for writing the screenplay for To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, wow.
And okay. He's a fantastic playwright. He's passed away now. He lived into his 90s, and in his 90s, he had a real renaissance. He was having his plays produced at Lincoln Center, and, you know. And Daisy told me one day about her father. She said, well, you know, he's the night the play premieres at Lincoln Center at the age of 91, you know, he's still pretty terrified about what those reviews are going to be.
Yeah. There's such and a humanness to that.
Yeah. It doesn't go away.
I love.
It doesn't go. And again, it shouldn't go away, because if you're risking something,
that's good.
Which is, I think, is crucial to a work of art having any meaning to other people, then of course you're going to be terrified. You've got to let yourself be vulnerable, and you've got to be asking yourself in the writing questions about yourself that other people can identify with. So, you know, I think I would be worried if I was publishing or premiering something that didn't make me nervous.
That's so good.
That would mean I wasn't risking anything, you know.
That's so good. I do a lot of speaking, and I'm working on a new talk right now. And, like, kind of the whole point of the talk is it's really based in kind of the importance of community and dense social networks. But a big thesis is that in order to build that, like, you have to risk and you have to be vulnerable and you have to kind of go first. But it's interesting, yeah, as I've been writing and developing this talk, I had the terrible, horrible moment where I realized, like, oh, if you're going to stand on a stage and tell thousands of people that they have to be vulnerable, the only way to do that in true authenticity is, like, what are you going to do literally actually while you're on stage that feels like a huge risk and that feels really vulnerable? And just being like, I can't truly tell you this thing that I think is just it's just a truth, whether or not I'm saying it or somebody else is saying it. But for me to be the vehicle of that truth, I literally have to, at the same time, I think, to a degree, embody the truth itself, which involves taking risk and kind of being vulnerable. And woo, it's so scary. And especially when you have that moment where you're like, damn it, I wish I could have not had that thought, because this was like, I was feeling really good about where this was going and confident. And but so often that's because we're still hiding and not taking that. But I think that you're so right.
But if you make yourself, I mean, speaking as a playwright, if you're a speaker on stage, it's basically a one person show, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you need every play, every performance needs stakes. It needs danger, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're up there alone, what are the stakes aside from sort of generic stage fright? The stakes are if you reveal something vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, especially of course if it has something integral to what you're speaking about.
Sure.
But that's just going to make your talk an even more riveting performance, you know, to actually expose something personal, either by implication or outright.
Sure.
To do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I try to do that when I lecture about playwriting. It's often like a hybrid with memoir, you know, because I don't want to just stand up there and like tell people how they should write plays, because A, I don't believe there's one way to do that. And B, I don't think anybody should care if I'm not trying to relate it to my own struggles to understand my craft, you know? Mm-hmm. So I always try to make it as personal as I can. And selfishly, okay, because maybe I think it's a more exciting performance if you do that.
Yeah. Yeah, you can. I mean, it's definitely, I feel like we've all been in an audience, whether it's a performance or a speech where it's like, oh, well, we were the 100th audience to get this exact thing. I think people know, they can sense and feel if you're taking a risk. Okay, I have like 10 more questions that I want to ask you, but I promise I'm going to land the plane. And I think the last question I'm going to ask you, I don't know that I've ever asked anybody before. Have you ever taken one of these risks? Have you ever been vulnerable, whether that's in your personal life or through your art, and regretted it? And been like, you know what, I think that was not the right time or place, or the risk felt too big, or like been on the other side of it and not be like, that was the right thing to do.
I don't know. I'm sure I have. I mean, I've always just had this sense that, and probably from reading writers like, again, Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath and Robert Lowell, the confessionalist poets and writers, the sense that being vulnerable, even if you overshoot the mark in some way, I've always had this almost like spiritual sense that it's worth it still. So I can obsess about a lot of things, but I don't tend to obsess about oversharing.
Yeah.
even though I'm sure that I do overshare or make myself too vulnerable at times. I'm sure, I mean, it's been interesting with this memoir to try to find the line between telling my story truthfully and trying to respect the privacy of family members and respect that they had different perspectives and opinions about our childhood, you know.
I've heard it said, this was just a few weeks ago, and I don't know who specifically you're referring to, but it was talking about how sibling relationships are often can be some of the most difficult human relationships, because oftentimes we have the same lived experience, but yet actually how it impacted us can be so different. And so unlike a friend who grew up in Oklahoma when I was in Missouri and like we didn't meet until our 20s, she can tell the story of her childhood and I'm just like all ears. Like whatever you say is truth. And like, I mean, tell me more. And I'm like, I have nothing at stake. I don't have anything to compare it to. Whereas when my sister talks about her childhood, how quickly I am to be like, that's not what happened, or that's not like, you know, and we have this different vantage point or a different experience, but it was like, no, we were in the same room when that same thing happened, but that changed you and impacted you based off of, you know, just the alchemy of who you are and your tendencies and your age at the time. It's like we could have, it's like we lived two completely different experiences, and how hard it is to like hold that, to say like, I believe you. And I honor that truth and that story that you're telling. Also, that is not how I remember it. You know, like that's a really challenging thing to hold.
I mean, I agree, but I also find that fascinating. The sort of, again, being one of six kids, you know, to think about all the different perspectives on this one family that I'm sure exists, not to mention my parents' perspective on the family. It just reminds me of my, so I think my second poetry collection was and is my most confessional poetry collection. It was very much about growing up in Scarsdale and my family. And my older sister, who I was and am estranged from, started emailing and calling editors and publishers, like anybody that had published a poem from the book, the publisher of the book, to complain and to say that I had written, you know, dishonestly about my childhood, which was fascinating to me because, A, it wasn't a memoir, it's poetry. So there's, you know, it's still, but then on top of that, it is, of course, one person's perspective on that. But she wrote to one of my publishers and said, she said, wouldn't it be interesting, you know, to publish another poetry collection by the sibling of a poet who's written about their childhood, you know? And it was kind of a rhetorical question. And but my publisher wrote to me and he said, you know, I was kind of intrigued by her. I didn't know if she was pitching me a book, but I was intrigued by this because his point of view was like, sure, go for it. You know, if you can write poetry and your sibling can, and sure, that could be really fascinating. My sister hasn't done that, but, you know, and the other thing I would say is I wrote a play that's a sort of a memoir play, and it's based on interviews with my relatives about my family, and that was a way to sort of embrace exactly what you're talking about, you know, to, because in these interviews we of course discovered that we overlapped in some ways and disagreed and had different different histories of our family, and to put that up on stage, I think that's a very theatrical way to explore the idea. Because, you know, the theater's all about different points of view, seemingly equal in value, you know. And so to have two characters talk about a very important incident, such as my brother's suicide attempt and have very different perspectives on what happened, even not just what it meant, but what happened. I think is fascinating. So I've tried to sort of embrace that. You know, I call the new book a memoir as opposed to an autobiography, because it's just as much about memory. It's just as much about my subjective story that I've developed for myself to help me understand my life, as opposed to something that is, you know, containing absolute truth.
And I've heard it also said, I'm not like a neurobiologist, so don't quote me here, or maybe rather fact check me, people. But I've heard that our memories, the analogy that I heard was that the more often, it's like a catalog, you know, of cards. And the more often you pull out a specific card that has a specific memory, that every time you pull it out, you're influencing the card, right? Where it's like the oils on your hands. Let's say you're standing in the rain when it happens, so it gets some raindrops on it. You're recalling it when you're in a state of fear. And so it's almost like that fear that you're experiencing 20 years later in the moment when you're recalling the memory, like a little dash of fear gets put on it. And there wasn't actually fear in there when you, and so the idea being that the more you recall a memory, actually the less and less reliable it becomes over time, as opposed to something where you're just like, oh, you know, you run into a friend from childhood and they share something with you and you're like, oh my gosh, I haven't thought about that in 20 years. And all of a sudden you can remember it, that's actually a way more accurate memory than a memory, you know, one of these like formative or core memories we might have as kids that we probably have over the course of our lifetime recalled and replayed 100 times. And in the course of that, the actual thing has like kind of changed and it had its own kind of process of like becoming. So not only are there other people's perspectives, but there's even like how our own like life experience has changed that thing that really is in the past, but it's actually continually evolving as well.
Yeah, I think we can't help but create a more cohesive story about ourselves. I think that gets shaken up every time you have a change, certainly a trauma in your life. I think that's when a narrative, a previous narrative about yourself and your life can feel shattered. And then you go through a period of kind of revising and putting things back together and maybe discovering a very different story. But I don't think we can help that. I think that's just part of having a sense of self. You know, otherwise, I think we'd have to feel like life was too random and chaotic, you know.
So good. Okay, Dan, I really could keep talking to you for a long time.
I know, me too. I love the podcast. I love the, you know, the approach to talking about failures, quote unquote failures. And yeah, I love it. It's great. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much. You have such an interesting voice, both out in the world, but also here with us today. And I'm just so grateful for all that you shared.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. And then is there anything that you want to make sure in my outro or intro that we talk about? I think we have information about the latest book, where it's available, all of that stuff. Is there anything specific that you want to make sure our listeners know?
No, I think that was great. I really love the podcast and I think that love talking about it. Yeah, I mean, just mentioning those, because it's actually three books that are coming out at once.
Oh, wow. Okay, awesome.
Yeah. But if that's not too much, you could always leave out the play collection book, because that's probably, you know, nobody necessarily buys plays. I don't know how much of a theater audience you have, but it's actually a collection of prose poems, memoir, and then the play collection. But no,
they're all coming out at the same time.
Yeah, they're all coming out in September, the same day. Poetry collection is September 15th, and the other two are at the end of the month, the 27th.
Ooh, I'm going to be thinking about you in September. Three back-to-back launches. That's a lot on the human mind and spirit. I guess easier than reading any of the reviews. But
A little bit easier.
I was laughing when you were sharing about you just don't read reviews. I've only written one book. And I have a tendency, I don't have OCD, but I can definitely read. Yeah. I have obsessive thought pattern tendencies. I thought, I kind of haven't remembered that I did this, but I took a completely opposite approach. So my book was coming out and I was just like nervous, you know, that people were just going to like tear it apart and I was going to get all these negative reviews. And so I thought that the best thing I could do for myself, I don't know if this is like a version of exposure therapy. I remember literally one night I was kind of in like an obsessive tear state. And I got on Amazon and I just started reading one-star reviews of everybody else's things. Because then I was like, if you expose yourself to trolls on the internet enough, like I wanted to create this like neuro thought pattern that was like, you respect and enjoyed and thought this person's work was valuable, but Bob in Arkansas hated it and tore it apart. But if I exposed myself enough to just terrible things that people were saying about other people, that by the time it got to me, it would like somehow not impact me anymore. The results of that experiment are very TBD, but...
Yeah, it's, I mean, I've done that. I think I've done the reverse many years ago where I would like, you know, comfort myself to read horrible reviews of James Joyce written by Virginia Woolf. Do you know what I mean? To say like, well, people think they're both great and they hated each other. So like, what does that tell you? But you're right. It only helps so far, I think, because when it's your own work, it still feels so personal, or it can feel so personal.
It still gives me diarrhea.
I mean, my wife, you know, my wife's an actor and a writer, and she's got a podcast, and, you know, she's occasionally, she'll look at reviews of her podcast, and I think her podcast has like 4.8 or 4.9 stars or something. But of course, you'll always look for the one that's one star, and whatever they say will stick with you, you know? So it's really hard.
It does. Gottman says that it takes, for every one negative interaction or like comment made, it psychologically takes 10 just to counterbalance
that
it.
That makes sense.
So frustrating. Like, really, why couldn't we be wired in the different direction? But here we are, doing the best we can with what we have. No. Dan, thank you so much. This truly
was
such a pleasure. Great. Best of luck to you in September.
Thank you.
Actually, you know what? I take it back, because you've already done the work. It's already out there. And so really September, I guess, is just going to be other people's opinions about it. So instead of saying best of luck, I'll say congratulations on creating some beautiful things that you're going to put into the world.
Thank you. It means a lot.
All right.
Thanks again for having me.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Plucking Up Podcast. For updates and announcements about the show, you can visit lizbohannon.co, or you can follow me on Instagram. I'm at lizbohannon, and I love hearing from my pluckies. So you know the drill. Until next week, stay plucky.